Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Today we're pressing on in and into the 18th century, which is a period generally understood as the Canal Age, though of course canals really developed later in the 18th century. And I want to start off by looking, first of all, at something I was talking about at the very end, which was the circumstances of coastal trade, but also I want to talk about river improvement. And my point here is a more general one, which is pertinent to transport as a whole, that often when people talk about transport, they talk about bold new initiatives, whether for good or ill, and one can think most recently of HS2, but that, or prior to that, possibly the Channel Tunnel, but that actually it is the bulk of the system, which often moves on a different trajectory, that is more important for the majority of travellers. And that remains the case for modern trains, or indeed the equivalent for roads. People aren't so much interested with roads about whether they may or may not produce a, let's say, new crossing of the Thames. What they're concerned about is potholes in their immediate neighbourhood. So we're going to go back to the 18th century, and I left the 18th century, talking about the difficulties of some of the travellers of the period, and in particular, talking about Jonathan Wilson, the Cumbrian malt dealer, and the difficulties he found in getting to Ireland. But he, of course, was not alone, and these affected the very height of society as well. George I, for example, in 1726, was driven ashore near Rye on his return from Hanover in a journey by land and sea, the end of his 1725 visit to Hanover, that the Saxon envoy referred to as nearly impractical and very dangerous, and in which George had nearly lost his life more than once. And it's worth bearing in mind that coastal travel across the nearby seas, could well be fatal. And if you had a bad accident, it could, you know, the long-term consequences of that could be difficult. And of course, it was also colder in that period. And obviously, these days, we are all aware that climate warming has its problems. But one ought to be aware that climate cooling had its problems as well. So, for example, in 1740, ice-stranded ships in the Humber estuary, hitting much more of trade and transport than would have been the case today. Winds cut off maritime links, affecting everything from trade and diplomacy to travel and newspapers. So, for example, I found a reference in the St. James's Post, which was a London newspaper, of the 13th of September 1717, which observed the contrary winds, by which it meant the winds from the west, continuing to deprive us of the Dutch mails, in other words, of the ships from Helvoet Sluis coming in with the mails, which would be not just the mails from the Hook of Holland, but also all the postal traffic from northern Germany, from Scandinavia, and from Russia. So adverse winds, continent cut off, as it were. And this theme was frequently reiterated, which was a testimony to its significance. These problems, and increasing the sources, as I can do, simply add to the list, underline the turmoil that travel could cause, and therefore the unpredictability and risk involved. And that was in peace years. Now, you can imagine that these became even more considerable in war years. For example, in 1745, when Britain was at war with both Spain and France, that Merchant Adventurers of Bristol, which was the leading mercantile company, one which in fact in this period was singularly unadventurous, successfully encouraged the city's MPs to press for a more powerful warship to provide nearby protection against privateers, not least because the insurers didn't think the current one was adequate. Well, I mean, the insurers, in other words, helping to set the parameters of financial possibility. And the idea of a much more direct relationship between members of parliament and defence than is the case today, and one that, were it to be repeated today, might actually have some interesting consequences. These and other factors, as I mentioned at the very outset, stand as a reproach to any focus solely on improvement, steady or otherwise, and they underline the need for repetition. So Graham very kindly wanted me to talk simply about canals in this period, but that's not appropriate. Although it's worth bearing in mind that novelty was not only a member of canals, and there were some important improvements elsewhere. So Liverpool Old Dock, built in 1705 to 15, was an enclosed dock that could accommodate up to 100 ships. And that very much meant that Chester was in the shadows. Underlining the significance of coastal trade, you could see that if it was an issue with coal, for example, being moved. I mean, the standard way in which coal was moved around the country was by water. If you had freezing or adverse winds affecting coastal trade, you get no water, you get no coal, and you freeze. Water routes, both coastal and internal, remained particularly favourable for the movement of heavy or bulky goods, for which road transport was inadequate and or expensive. So, and this is reiterating a point we've made in the last 2 weeks, the Severn was the major north-south route for freight in the West Midlands and was particularly important for the movement downriver of coal from East Shropshire Coalfield. Now, we don't have an East Shropshire Coalfield today, but the nearest equivalent to the Severn would be the M5 motorway. Goods carried upstream on the Severn included products from outside Britain, such as wine, Baltic timber, and from further afield, tea, sugar, spices, tobacco, and citrus fruit, most of which had been transshipped at Bristol, although Gloucester was also a transshipment point. And that transshipment included from elsewhere in Britain. And as I mentioned last time, tributaries such as the Warwickshire Avon for the Severn further extended the river systems, whilst also ensuring the need for bridges, ferries or forts. Moreover, and again, as I mentioned the last two times, and I underline this point because continuity is often more important than change, and to use the modern jargon, is underpriced in most historical accounts, the river system had many deficiencies. Rivers didn't always supply the necessary links, for example, between Somerset and both Devon and Dorset. While many rivers were not navigable, transport was often only easy downstream when the current helped one, and many rivers were obstructed, as we noticed last time, by mills and weirs. Moreover, the un- or poorly controlled flow of water ensured that spring thaws, autumn floods can bring problems by sending rivers into spate, while in the summer, due to lower rainfall, they could be too shallow to use. And this was a particular problem in the upper rate parts of rivers, and also means that the head of a river, in other words, the limit to which it was navigable, varied considerably by the season. Thus, for example, in the North Riding of Yorkshire, the navigable rivers, the Tees, the Ouse and the Derwent, were all on its boundaries, while within it, the Swale, the Esk and the Rye were too swift, too shallow or liable to flood for navigation. And as a result, lead from the western dales of Yorkshire had to be moved overland to the Tees ports, places like Stockton, which was a very expensive process. Now, I don't mean by this to wish to ignore the problems of moving by land, but all I'm trying to do is to show that you have to be very, very cautious before assuming that you have got necessarily a particularly good system. What this meant is that until the 1750s, when a period of canal construction began, the improvement of rivers took precedence over canals, and there were peaks of activity both in the late 1690s, which I referred to last time, and in 1719 to 21. For example, in a undated fly sheet I found in the archives, in fact, in the archives at Bristol Library, called Reasons for Making the River Avon Navigable from Bristol to Bath, a case was made for an improvement that was to be made, in fact, by 1727. And this is the case that was made. Quote, well, this is the substance of it, from a passage in it. Bristol and Bath are situate in a rich soil, but surrounded by a mountainous country, so that land carriage is very chargeable and difficult, and therefore not only weighty, but light and bulky goods if they're carried on horseback or on men's shoulders. In other words, it's too difficult to move them by carts. The neighbouring counties of Gloucester, Wiltshire, etc. find it more easy to bring goods 80 miles from London than 20 from Bristol. Personally, I doubt that, but that's the kind of thing that was said in pamphlets. Whereas if this river be made navigable, it will open such a prospect for trade in all the adjacent counties, silence those who take advantage from their being locked in, i.e. what we would call profiteers, by enhancing the price of all necessaries. The improvement owed a lot to Ralph Allen, who made money from his contracts with the post office before purchasing quarries of Bath Stone at Coombe Down and Bathampton. The river improvement ensured that the stone could be transported to Bristol and beyond. In about 1730, indeed, Allen had a wooden railway constructed on the Tyneside model, where they were already used for coal, using it to bring stone from his quarries on Coombe Down to a wharf on the River Avon at Whitcomb. This stone, in part, served to support the expansion of Bath. So in other words, entrepreneurship for particular interests is portrayed as advantageous and also as attacking restrictive practices. Similarly, the Yare was made more navigable between Great Yarmouth and Norwich, helping Norfolk's grain exports and also the movement of coal from northeast England via Great Yarmouth to Norwich. The funds had been made available by a 1698 Act of Parliament, providing for tolls for coal traffic using the Yare with the money for river improvements and for harbour works at Great Yarmouth, where goods were transshipped onto smaller ships for the journey upriver. A improvement bill for the River Weir failed in 1706, but a successful one was passed in 1717, establishing the River Weir Commissioners, who improved the harbour at Sunderland. Work on the Mersey to improve navigation to Manchester began in 1724. The Douglas between Wigan and the sea was open to navigation in 1742, and improvements to the Weaver helped Cheshire's economy. When I say improvements, what you're doing is you're taking out things like shoals in the river. This river was a substitute for the movement of by pack horse of coal from Lancashire and North Staffordshire to the mid-Cheshire salt industry. So Cheshire was a major supplier of salt, as it still is, mined underground. And of course, in order to process the rock salt that was mined, it had to be heated. The coal was used for it. Improving the navigation ensured that this was more economic. Four bills had been brought before Parliament between 1711 and 1720 with improvement in mind to the River Weaver, but the first three were thwarted by the overland carriers, in other words, the people that moved the coal overland as opposed to by water, as well as the concerns of riverside farmers over fishing rights and possible flooding if the river was improved. The 1720 bill, in contrast, succeeded the following year and provided for the construction of 12 locks on the Weaver, which were to be funded by tolls. In other words, the tolls were legitimated by Parliament. And this 22.5-mile navigation was opened in 1731 with the boats hauled by men. A towpath was only opened in 1792, and only then could horses be used. Other acts of 1721 and 1734 opened the way for extension of the system on the Weaver as far as Nantwich and on the Dane tributary to Middlewich, but neither, in fact, was done. And of course, it's always important to look at implementation as well as just simply legislation, because 34 acts for river improvement were passed between 1689 and 1727, showing the way in which the so-called Glorious Revolution led in that respect to improvement. And in fact, there was an expansion. The mileage of navigable rivers in England rose from 685 in 1660 to 1,160 in 1725. So that's nearly doubling. And there was a general theme was offered, at least in those newspapers and other commentators that wished to praise change, that improvement, such as river improvement, offered a way to escape what was seen as a cyclical pattern of history of rise and decline. So the Honest True Briton, the title of the newspaper expressing its aspiration and opinion of the 22nd of May 1724, declared, quote, "Empires and kingdoms, how flourishing and powerful soever, are not immortal. All lesser states have the same uncertain fate attending them. And as nothing but numbers of people industriously employed in trade and manufactories, in husbandry and navigation could build up a mighty empire, so nothing can preserve and prolong it by the continuance of the same methods by which it was raised." Incidentally, it's worth bearing in mind, at the present moment, of course, it's highly contentious the extent to which slavery and sugar was the basis for the modern British economy. Actually, if you look at the legislative and commentary on improvement in the early 18th century, sugar is fairly marginal. The key things were seen as coal and the improvements to the domestic economy, which made coal easier to move and easier to apply. So we can go on with rivers. For example, if you move to Lincolnshire, the Foss Dyke between Lincoln and the Trent, built by the Romans, was restored in 1740 to 44. The improvement of the Witham to Lincoln was largely complete by 1770. In 1731, the poet Alexander Pope referred to, quote, "rolling obedient rivers through the land." In practice, the possibilities for improving rivers were very much determined by the courses of the latter, by the course of the river themselves, but there were also rival economic and political interests that played a role. So with the River Dee in Cheshire in 1732 to 4, there were big political rows as to what whether there should be improvement, how much it should cost, and what should be done. Or Great Yarmouth took most of the money that could have been spent on the River Yare improvements until an act specified that the port should only have 40% of the tolls raised and the other 60% should be spent on the river. There were also setbacks, with projects taking longer than anticipated or proving more difficult, as of course never happens in the modern age, which is so much better. Thus, in April 1719, an act was passed for, quote, "enlarging the time," end of quote, granted by legislation of the late 1690s for cleansing and making navigable the channel from the Hythe at Colchester to Wivenhoe, and for making the said act more effectual. The Hampshire Avon, not its true major river, was improved from 1675 to enable commercial navigation from Salisbury to the sea at Christchurch, but the link proved impossible after 1715, and by 1722, two unsuccessful attempts had been made to re-establish the route. Aside from such work on, for example, dredging, which was a key problem, towing paths were constructed along rivers as far as possible, but often taking a long time to finish off, to permit the replacement of human bow haulers, pullers of the boats, by horses. Whatever the level of improvement, river transport could be hazardous. For example, Thomas Tanner, the Dean of Norwich, was appointed Bishop of St. Asaph in Wales. He travelled to Wales by sea to London, up the Thames to Oxford, and then overland to North Wales. His goods included huge quantities of his manuscripts and books, but the barges ran aground in Abingdon, possibly having been swamped by a storm that was on the Thames. Once dried, they had to be taken to Wales. In other words, even on a moving aside from coastal travel, you could have storms causing capsizes on rivers. The Thames, of course, remained significant as a river system. As for the wheat sold at Reading Market in 1734, which was mostly en route to export from London. Indeed, the Thames, I think it's fair to say, remains the most important transport system in southern England in the 18th century, irrespective of the turnpikes that are built, and irrespective of the canals that are to be built. And I think this is an important point, because it's obviously the case that people find it more interesting are to focus on the latter. But that's inappropriate. And indeed, writing in the Newcastle Journal of the 17th of July, 1740, Philalates, which is obviously a pseudonym, portrayed the grain market as nationally linked, quote, London, which place governs the value of all grain in England. All the markets in England have a natural dependence on each other and expect a mutual assistance. Now, what he's talking about there is the way in which, as a result of coastal traffic, as we discussed last time, grain coming in from East Anglia, Kent and Sussex, and the Thames, that in a sense there is a key national market for grain, and that key national market for grain in turn is London, and it can then set the prices in part because of the extent to which areas where prices are lower, people find it advantageous to ship from it, which of course in turn causes causes riots, as in Stockton in 1739, where people in the northeast of England, sort of riot against grain being moved by coastal vessels to London, because they're concerned to make sure that the grain is available in their area at a low enough price. Now, we've talked about the first half of the century. I want to move on to the second half of the century, and I want to begin, again, newspapers are very interesting, with an excerpt from the Newcastle Chronicle of the 6th of January, 1787. And this is pertinent because, first of all, it's worth bearing in mind when you consider how dire local newspapers are at the present moment in most of Britain, starting with the Evening Standard, which is pretty awful. But one of the interesting points about local newspapers in the past is they also commented extensively, not only in their own locality, but on other parts of the country, and therefore could create a sense of a national mood politically or of national resonant economic news. So this is Newcastle Chronicle beginning, a letter from Cirencester, Gloucestershire. For non-Brits, well, indeed, most Brits have no idea of geography, Cirencester is a long way from Newcastle. A letter from Cirencester, Gloucestershire says, quote, "A navigable work of a most arduous and extensive nature is now carrying on in this neighbourhood," so that's in the Cotswolds, "which is nothing less than a junction between the Thames and Severn. In this undertaking, a prodigious mountain of more than 2.5 miles in length will be cut through so that barges of 50 or 70 tons burden may pass. Near 2 miles of this subterraneous work are nearly finished, and the whole navigation, which is nearly 30 miles long, is expected to be finished in a year and a half. When completed, London will have a grand inland navigation with almost all parts of England and Wales." Well, that's an exaggeration, but it certainly meant that you'd be able to get through to the Severn system, "so that the trade thereupon must be immense. The people near the part of it that is already finished feel its good effects by a considerable reduction in the price of coals." Again, coal is the crucial thing. Again, put aside this nonsense that sugar or colonial goods are the fundamental driver of economic change. It's just not true. Now, in the second half of the 18th century, as we've already observed when we were talking about roads with turnpikes, there was large-scale expansion in the transport infrastructure. And the same thing is obviously true if we're looking at rivers and canals. And when I make that point, I want to make it clear that although we're going to be focusing on canals, there continued to be improvement to rivers, and rivers continued to be very consequential. And indeed, I think it's fair to say that many canals were only important, at least in part, because they helped to provide links between rivers, though there were also new canals, and to give that and reflecting a major sense, a new routes, I mean, a major sense of new potential, one can take 1767. The gentleman and scientist, Joseph Banks, who was to become most famous, of course, For his role in the public patronage of science and also for going with Cook to the Pacific, Joseph Banks viewed the Bridgewater Canal, which is interesting because the Bridgewater Canal, in some respects, for some people, was exotic. The Bridgewater Canal reflected trade is opened between two very large towns, he means Manchester and Liverpool, before labouring under the great inconveniences. They were indeed the second and third largest towns in population, respectively, in England in the 1810 census. And again, worth bearing in mind, because it's all too easy to focus on the, the extent to which we should be concerning ourselves with what's going on abroad and Britain's international linkages. It's domestic changes that are really important. The difference of scale from the situation in the first half was striking, and this was true in routes as well as in services, and for rivers linked to canals as well as freight moving by road. Freight moved by rivers continues to be the major theme. I mean, I'm not denying that there is freight moved by the turnpikes. And equally, it's the case that the ratio between land and water transport varies greatly. But I think it's worth saying that although there are some places that are not canal areas or areas of improving rivers, Essex is one, and Essex was very much dependent on roads for its links, Chelmsford and Colchester being key secondary road nodes, and the biggest node for Essex being London. Nevertheless, there were other areas in which road transport was very much dependent on and linked to canals. For example, after the opening of Samuel Greig's cotton mill at Quarry Bank in Cheshire, south of Manchester in the 1780s, wagons carrying his raw cotton and spun yarn went to and from his warehouse on the Bridgewater Canal. So in other words, the canal, the warehouse, the cotton mill, and the wagons on roads were all significant. Same with the linkage between rivers and wall and wagonways, for example, the Tyne and the Wear for the coal trade, but also the Severn for the Coalbrookdale works, the iron works at Coalbrookdale in Shropshire, where large iron cylinders were made for steam engines being hauled thence to the river, the Severn, by horses along a wooden wagonway. Both were necessary, and you couldn't have one without the other. And again, I think this is an important point, because so often the tendency is to just look at one, not the other, or to see them as competitive. Whereas what I would argue is that the key element is a kind of symbiosis. River improvement, as I've mentioned, continued in the second half of the 18th century. So Jackson's Oxford Journal of the 3rd of July, 1790, included a notice of a committee meeting on the Thames navigation to consider proposals for erecting a lock near Godstow and for ballasting the shallows between there and Osney. However, although revived in 1754, a proposal to make the River Weir navigable from Sunderland to Durham was expensive, didn't attract investors, and was not started. Indeed, I think it's worth saying that many of the obvious river routes had already been done. The rivers, therefore, there was only so much that could be added. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that rivers have the great potential of flowing water, whereas with canals, you have to ensure a water supply, which is an added cost and difficulty. But nevertheless, canals had an enormous amount of potential. There were certainly more canals in the second half of the 18th century than in the first half. In 1765, for example, Wedgwood, the great pottery entrepreneur, turned to James Bridley, who had made his reputation planning this canal, to link the Trent and the Mersey. Bridley did this with the Grand Trunk Canal, so-called, completed a decade later in 1775. In addition, the building of the 46-mile-long Staffordshire and Worcester Canal from the Trent and Mersey Canal between 1766 and 1772 added a link to the new Birmingham Canal and to the River Severn at the new port of Stourport, so that Staffordshire's coal, iron and pottery could be readily transported to the major English cities. And obviously, for Wedgwood or the Wedgwood family, that was the key thing with pottery. For families like Earl Gower's family, key political family, but also very interested in Staffordshire mining, this was all important. And the first coal barge arrived in Birmingham in 1772. Coal therefore fell in price, therefore that helped industrial production. This system in the West Midlands was amplified with additional links and spurs. For example, the Dudley and Stourbridge canals opened in 1779, which improved links between the Severn and the Black Country. Aside from the development of canal systems, there was also the digging of individual canals to create or improve particular links. For example, 1770 saw the opening of the Louth Canal, making Louth a port. Not a particularly significant thing on the national level, but very important locally. And demand for coal helped to drive the growth of the canal system. And more specifically, I would say, that of the horse-drawn railways of the period. The horse-drawn railways I've already mentioned in the case of Ralph Allen at Bath, but was also the case with people moving coal as to the wharfs on the Wear and the Tyne. So, for example, Thomas Pennant, whose travels that were published in the 18th century, wrote of Newcastle upon Tyne in 1769, quote, "The great business of the place is the coal trade. The coal is brought down in wagons upon railroads and discharged from covered buildings at the edge of the water, that's at the in the wharfs, into the keels of boats that are to convey it." Now, I think it's worth important to make the point that the absence of canals as a feeder to the rivers in this region, the Northeast did not have very many canals, or as a separate system, helps to explain the development of horse-drawn railways and later the railway in the Northeast. There's less need immediately for horse-drawn railways or later the locomotive railway in the West Midlands because the canal system, the river system, is so extensive. Going back indeed to the West Midlands, Sir Roger Newdigate MP noted in 1767, quote, "A navigable canal from the Trent to Coventry is determined upon, and our surveyor is very positive it may be continued upon one level," in other words, not requiring locks, "to within 6 miles of Banbury, and by locks through the Vale of Cherwell and to the university," by which he means to Oxford. "This is a great project, too great, it seems, for our gentry to comprehend at once. But as soon as the Coventry Canal is set about, I dare say their eyes will be opened. The advantages of it are so great, it must force its way, if practical, as we are told it is." That's a very clear-cut view. The Coventry Canal carried coal from the 1780s and the completion of the Oxford Canal in 1790. So that's the canal route he's talking about via Banbury to Oxford. And you can still walk along that on the west side near the Jericho area of Oxford. It was followed by the advertising for sale at so-called Coal Wharf in Oxford of Warwickshire Coal and Staffordshire Coke, which, what a surprise, benefited the interests of the Newdigate family. Horse-drawn railways were also elsewhere. So the 25-mile-long Glamorganshire Canal along the Taff Valley from Merthyr Tydfil to the sea at Cardiff, constructed in 1790 to 94, was supplemented by tram roads or feeder railways. So also from the east Shropshire coalfield to wharfs on the River Severn. I think we ought to pause there because we're not going to finish the late 18th century, but we've started it. And I wonder, Graham, if you've got any particular points you'd like to raise.
Well, we certainly have started it, and there's a lot to cover in what you said. I want to try and ask initially about the funding of these improvements. Firstly, the improvements to river navigability, and whether the funding model, were there different funding models, or was there a fairly uniform model? And did that change later for how the presumably, on the whole, more expensive construction of canals were funded?
Well, tolls, charges, is the key element. So you've got exactly the same proposition as a turnpike. You get an Act of Parliament enabling you to build from A to B, and crucially enabling you to levy a toll or charge in order to cover the costs. And once that's the case, then it's a speculation. People, knowing that they will, if the canal gets completed, receive a revenue based on the dividends, essentially. What they want to do then is to be willing to cough up some money themselves, not least because there's often interests involved. I mentioned the Newdigates, I mentioned Gower, I mentioned Wedgwood. There'll be interests who are directly involved in the further benefit that's going to come to their particular companies. So it wasn't that difficult to raise money for canals. And you've got to remember, Britain has... It's the most successful trading company in the world. It's raising considerable sums of money as a result, particularly through the re-export trade. It's Europe's largest producer of coal. There's a lot going on that is producing revenues for the British economy. It has, by modern standards, a low-tax society, in which the principal obligation on the state is defence and tackling the debt on the national debt. And that, again, they're not the national state is not really dealing with issues that now take a lot of the fisc and squeeze profitability of private sector and investment opportunities, things like, health, education. So the result of all that is you've got, a lot of money available for investment.
In the first half of the 18th century, where we're for the most part talking more about improvements to rivers, you mentioned the role of dredging to stop silting up, and also the creation of towpaths initially for men to draw barges and later for horses. Was there much work done at the same time on straightening rivers to make them more easily navigable, or what was that left really to late in the century with the construction of canals?
No, there were indeed. I mean, for example, the river in the Oxbow Lake is, or the Oxbow Bend, if you like, is anathema to the River Improver. So taking out Oxbow Bends was very important, not least because that increases the flow on the river and therefore the speed at which the water moves and therefore the speed at which the boats move. So no, river straightening is a marvellous thing, and in effect, dredging is another form of river straightening, because you're straightening, if you like, the bottom, and therefore you're reducing the drag or friction, which again creates problems.
It's very clear that if you're moving large bulky items like wheat or coal, it makes sense to cut them by waterways rather than by roads if you can. But I'm wondering for smaller items. So let's say I've got some personal goods to move from Oxford to London. Would it be quicker and cheaper to go, I'm in the middle of the 18th century, to go by the Thames or to go by the roads to London?
Certainly cheaper by river, probably quicker by road. So you've got a trade-off there that you have to think about. And of course, you've got other issues. Fragility, the more fragile it is, the better it is to move by water, because obviously, being in either a cart or a carriage is being pulled by horses, you have more issues and more problems. So it depends what it's going to be. A lot of things go around the country. I mean, as you may know, I've written several books on newspaper history of the 18th century. And the peddlers who take the newspapers around the country are usually on a weekly schedule, will move by horseback because that has a local penetration that the river system doesn't have other than along riverbanks. Goods that are those that are have value but are not likely to attract much damage. So a classic example of that is they usually sell books. But obviously, if you're taking anything that's higher bulk, water is always more satisfactory. And not least because if you have to have lots of wagons, you've got the cost, or carts, you've got the cost of all the forage for all those vehicles.
And in the mid-18th century, the journey time for taking, let's say I'm taking items from one house to another, from Oxford to London, if I was taking it by the Thames, how many days would that take on average?
I mean, first of all, it depends on the circumstances. I mean, obviously, it depends upon whether you're going to find a boat. It depends upon the river conditions, et cetera, et cetera. But you will notice that I referred to Thomas Tanner going in the opposite direction from London to Oxford. And Thomas Tanner uses a boat to take all his books, because you've got to remember that unless there is a high spoilage, there is no particular problem with delay. I mean, with coal or grain, or in fact, the movement of, you know, your books, Graham, there is no particular problem if it gets longer delayed. Now, a classic good that moves by road by the late 18th century is a relatively new one, which are people moving fish in essentially movable water containers, which are attached to carts. They're covered in carts. So the idea is that inland towns can get fish brought in from the coast without it rotting so much. Now, those in which time is a premium, they go by road. Newspapers, time is a premium, it goes by road. But where there isn't a premium on time, water has a major advantage.
Well, fascinating. We must leave it there, though. We'll go on and talk about waterways into the 19th century next time. But talking us through river improvements and canals in the 18th century, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. And listeners may be interested in my book, Britain in the 18th Century, which, you know, covers a wide range of topics of that period. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.